What's up, everybody? I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got very special guest Mike McGlone, where I took the day to go down to the Bloomberg offices in Miami to go and visit him, see what's up with the overall macro, see what traditional finance is thinking of the BlackRock ETF, and much, much more. So we had an absolute firecracker of a conversation. So be sure to subscribe to the podcast. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, this is not financial advice. Everything you hear in this podcast should not be taken as financial advice. Also, big shout out to my sponsor, Stampseed, the number one place where you can store your Bitcoin seed phrase is a titanium punch plate from Stampseed. You can do all that and get 15% off when you use promo code GREENCANDLE. They've got a sick hammer. They got a lot of great stuff. They've even got the Bitcoin B. You can customize it a little bit yourself. A lot of great stuff going on at Stampseed. So be sure to go and get yourself a punch plate. And shout out to Bitcoin News, the number one place to get your news about Bitcoin. Wow, what'd you think? And they got the best newsletter in the game. So go ahead and subscribe to their newsletter. Join thousands of others where we are all getting great information from this newsletter. And I've got some merch, so check out the link in the bio. Also, big shout out to Bitcoin Racing and the fellas. Shout out to Chris, Primetime, McKenzie. All right, enough for me. Let's get into the show. Whoosh. All right, we're ready. We're live. We're good? All right. Bing bong. I'm back with another State of Bitcoin podcast where I'm in the Bloomberg offices with very special guest, Mike McGlone. Mike, how you doing today?
I'm good, Brendan. Thanks for coming. Very special. I don't know. We do love our offices here in Miami.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's awesome. You know, we were talking a little bit about this pre-show. It's like, you know, Wall Street 2.0 down here. So there's a lot of great stuff going down here in Miami. But, you know, obviously you work for Bloomberg, and traditional finance is starting to come around to Bitcoin. And so I want to start off there because I believe Bloomberg predicted 500K Bitcoin in 24 or 25 time. And from what I've heard from you, you're a little bit more on the bearish perspective just from the macro. So how are you looking at this overall situation? And do you think that we would actually get to a 500K Bitcoin in the next year, year and a half?
So Bloomberg doesn't really predict anything, or would have major issues with compliance, but there might be a specific Bloomberg person at Bloomberg that would predict such things. And as I've been reminded by people, I did do that. I predicted 100,000 by 2025. And I think it was 2020. I don't remember exactly when. And people have a tendency to remind me that in bear markets. I'm like, okay, I'm sorry. But it's funny, that's the thing you learn about in my business. I'm an ex-trader, ex-money manager, ex-hedge fund guy. And some people always remind you when you're right, and some people always remind you wrong. Now I'm just a sayer. I don't really do it, but I still stick with that. 2025 is next year. And it's just watching simple things I look at as a commodity guys. Definable diminishing supply. We get all that. Increasing demand and adoption. And just like you said, starting off, you know, Wall Street's starting to figure it out.
Yeah.
Traditional finance is starting to get it. And if there's money to be made, they're all over it. But the key thing I've always loved about Bitcoin from the beginning is I come from a trading environment. I started in the trading pits in Chicago when I was your age. What a cool place. Just imagine being 20-ish. I don't have to know your age. 20-ish, making a lot of money, having a lot of fun. And in the pits, I was on the phone. So I was one of those guys on the phones. And the thing I learned right away is there's people, humans, a lot of humans are addicted to trading. Certainly the Asians, but a lot of humans are addicted to trading. And this vehicle, I noticed right away, is perfect trading vehicle. And that's what I think Wall Street's picking up on it. I've been saying this for years. I got a lot of pushback years ago. It's the most significant 24/7 traded risk asset ever. And it's just still going that way. So that's what I like. But first, you have that trading liquidity. You have the interest. And then we have that more specific, you know, macroeconomic factor of it's becoming digital gold and we're going digital. So that's what kind of, to me, is the whole space of the background for me in Bitcoin was coming from trading. And a lot of the ex-traders I know, most of them who are kind of retired or who are still in the business, they all just have gone to Bitcoin, at least for some kind of trading, because it's in their blood.
Yeah.
100%. So, you know, you mentioned something unique there, right? I mean, you're coming from the traditional finance background, right? Where it's like 9:30 to 4 about is the market open, right? Bitcoin's 24/7. Yeah. Do you think that's going to revolutionize traditional finance, where maybe we'll get something where, I mean, I know Robinhood's already like toyed around with, you know, being able to buy, I think at like 7 and then, you know, buy aftermarket at like 5:30 or 6. They're starting to toy around with that. Do you think that's the future where it's almost going to be 24/7 markets?
So that's the broad stock market, New York Stock Exchange. And now it's all up with the electronic exchanges. But where I came from, I started in the business trading the night session at Chicago Board of Trade futures. So futures have been almost around the clock forever. That's why I think futures people gravitate towards Bitcoin more closely. But that's a key point, I think. It's, to me, it's just a matter of time that through a token, you'll be able to track and or be able to get exposure to risk assets or assets on a global basis. That's why I always like to point out to everybody I speak to who don't, it's not widely known that Bitcoin is not the most widely traded crypto. It's Tether, the US dollar. And I love the way you respond that people in the crypto space get it. But when you pointed out to TradFi people, which is a term I love learning from crypto people, I remember learning skateboard terms from my son, my brother, who was 10 years younger than me, but it's really cool. The nomenclature is awesome. But when I love every place I go, most people don't know that. Teachers, professors, professionals, everything, you just don't understand that you click on coinmarketcap.com, you click on buying, and it's the dollar. That's the key thing I've been saying for years is the U.S. might, we might beat each other up about this, but we're not going to mess it up.
Yeah.
It's the American culture. There's money, it's trades a dollar, there's votes, and a lot of revenue. So it's just, you know, it's, and it tracks the buck. The whole system's gone for the buck. So that's why I like to point out. But the key thing I think is, so that's a tokenized version of the dollar is Tether, right?
Yeah.
People call it, they call them stable coins. I call them crypto dollars.
Yeah.
Because
I mean, they're pretty similar, right? I mean, that's what,
they're just like euro dollars.
Yeah.
Just the new technology. But how many track anything but the dollar? Would 1%? I've never been able to find them, not big ones. So I don't want to go there too much, but to me, that's the foundation in terms of the technology that everybody's starting to get, that we'll be able to do this with all liquid assets. Now here, the next ones that are really kind of on the radar are US Treasuries. So to be able to trade and get exposure to a US Treasury bond on a weekend, I think is going to be quite profound.
Yeah. Do you think that's going to revolutionize like the, I guess, the bond market and everything else, right? Because I mean, there's been a lot of worries just generally kind of people tracking the bond market with the way that overall macro environment's going right now. A lot of people, like, I mean, especially in the Bitcoin space, they think, you know, trading bonds and doing all that is relatively dead. Do you think that that would be maybe another shot in it where it's like, hey, you know, not as many people are buying up bonds, so we need to figure out a way to get, you know, incentivize people to do that. And so that we would offer it, whether it's, you know, backed by something similar to Tether or something where you can purchase it and, you know, trade it 24/7, 365.
I think it's a matter of time. And it's, you did remind me the one thing I've heard that's most significant about Tether. It's one of the biggest holder U.S. Treasury securities.
Yeah.
On the planet. It's like, if you're the U.S. government, why would you mess that up?
Yeah.
Some silly people might arguments against it, but I look at it as, I use the example of, if you're an exchange, a regulated exchange like the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, you got to be looking over your shoulder and say, we've got to adopt this technology and fall behind. I like to use the example of in 2022, the nickel market broke down. It just locked up, limit up. It was up, like, I think it went to $100,000 per metric ton. Now, last I saw, it was around like 16. Jeez. Broke a bunch of trades. The LME was way under the gun for not doing whatever they did not do properly. I don't know. But there is a technology. They don't have to use these classic, you know, somewhat open outcry electronic systems. That's somewhat foolproof. And that's what's happening with this space. So I think it's a matter of time. Exchanges have to adopt the technology. It's a question of how it migrates. I don't really understand as much. But to be able to get exposure to an asset via token is unstoppable, in my view. And I'll give you one example I think most people don't in this space don't know is there's a court case, an example of the ICE Futures Exchange grabbed the WTI futures contract from the CME, put it on their exchange and started trading. They took that intellectual property and started trading. The CME sued them, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and lost because the conclusion was that contract, once it gets on the screen, is in the public domain and everybody's allowed to trade on it. I don't know about everybody, but
yes,
the LME was allowed to do that. So that precedent, this was a global case, I think will trickle down into what's happening with tokenization of assets. I see that because that really affected me when I was in that space. I don't see what stops it. And the thing that really struck me was a few years ago. Remember Cy Sheffield of Visa? He was, he did a Laura Shin podcast. You probably know, you've heard of Laura
Shin. Yeah.
And he pointed out, hey, well, at Visa, we are definitely using crypto dollars, stable coins, because it's a better way to transact to close out our dollar balances.
Interesting. Wow. I'm going to have to go back and re-listen to that one because, I didn't know that Visa was utilizing it. I know that
MasterCard too.
Yeah. I know that Visa and MasterCard, they have a lot of, they've partnered with some, crypto companies, and they've given, you know, cards that give you rewards in crypto and whatnot. I think that they've partnered with Coinbase. I know Strike and like a few of these other ones as well. So that doesn't surprise me. I just, you know, I would think that, you know, with the Bitcoin and the Lightning Network, that Visa and MasterCard would try to, I guess, move away from it, right? Because the fee-based model, whenever you swipe that card, that 3-7% fee, depending on if it's Visa or MasterCard, American Express, gets basically eliminated once the Lightning Network kind of develops and goes through there. But before we get into all of that, I want to ask you on how you view Bitcoin as an asset, because I believe that I saw an article on Bloomberg. I don't know if it was an analyst that wrote it or what, but that said in 25 that it will essentially like not become or not be considered a risk on asset. And, you know, obviously the way it is now with the volatility and everything like that, especially with traditional finance coming in, it's viewed that way as a risk on asset. So how do you view it currently and how do you see it kind of playing out? Do you see it,
I guess, decoupling? It is a risk asset.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's becoming less riskier in every day. This is one thing I love pointing out is the best way I think to compare is the volatility compared to beta, which is the S&P 500. Mm-hmm. And when futures were first launched in 2017, it was trading, the annual volatility of Bitcoin was almost, I think, 7 to 10 times greater than S&P 500. Now it's 3 times, a little bit less than 3 times.
Yeah.
You see that trajectory? It's going down because every day there's more and more people involved. But it still is almost 3 times the volatility of the S&P 500, almost the same, about the same as gold. So I think it's a matter of time that its volatility would continue to decline. But becoming risk off is quite a statement versus becoming risk neutral, which is kind of what gold is.
Okay.
And risk off is more treasury bonds. I think I've been saying for years, it's going there. It's just a matter of time, but it's got to get through the big test.
Yeah.
And to me, the big test is the next correction in beta. Now that might have started. Now we're recording on May 3rd.
Yeah.
And S&P 500 has been maybe started a correction. It might have been short term right back up. But it's got to get through the first big test. And what's happened at the same time the S&P 500 beta peaked, about the same time Bitcoin's peaked.
Yeah.
They both have dropped. Bitcoin dropped below 60,000. It's right around there as we speak. S&P 500 dropped below 5,000. It's bounced back above. But you see the connection there?
Yeah.
Yet at the same time, at the end of April, gold closes at its highest end of month close ever. So I'm still bullish gold. And the way I like to describe it is you just can't be involved or invested in gold anymore without some Bitcoin in that space. And unless you want to take that inordinate risk of Bitcoin becoming the new digital version. So right now, I still think it's got to get over that test.
Yeah.
And that's why I keep the thing people think is what's your view of Bitcoin. I have to be careful, especially in the direct view about Bitcoin, because Bloomberg's asked me to curtail coverage. Change of management, I get it. I love working for Bloomberg. I just do what they say. But there's so much more I can do. And that to me is where we are right now is Bitcoin is still a much riskier asset than the S&P 500. It's the fastest horse in the race. S&P 500 goes up 10%. Bitcoin typically goes up 30 to 40%. It's about 3 times the vol. And it's also on the same way down. But I want to see us get over that period. And one thing I'm really worried about right now to bring it into shorter term is we just had the perfect storm for a new high in Bitcoin. And we got that. A lot of crypto people, I think like yourself, predicted that with the halving, with the ETFs, and with beta on a tear, right? Now it's all over. So when you're trading, you always want to look for, what's that, my dangling carrot of bullishness? Okay, so now we're seeing ETF outflows. People who had the all-time high, we're done with the halving. And beta looks like it's backing up. So to me, the environment right now is this hangover might last a while. And I'm just waiting for that test. Can we get through this test? At some point, we're going to see a bear market. At some point, we're going to see at least a correction in beta.
Yeah.
And we have to see how Bitcoin reacts. And I think right now, most people understand who are getting in and manage the space that if the stock market goes higher, you're probably going to outperform in Bitcoin. But if the stock market goes down, you still have that greater risk for now. Let's get over that hump. Right now, it's still showing, certainly as the time of the recording for this year, it's showing that it outperforms, but it still goes down at a similar velocity when the stock market goes down.
Yeah. So you brought up like curtailing a little bit of the Bitcoin coverage, right? So I want to dive into a little bit of that because I feel like traditional finance is new to Bitcoin, right? I mean, like obviously the ETFs are just kind of rolling out this year, but you know, Bloomberg's been covering it for a little bit. Fidelity has been kind of covering it for, I think, since 2017. And a few others as well have been at least like, you know, doing some research, right? I mean, even though the ETFs just launched, you have to assume that they've been doing their fair share of research for years on end before trying to launch a product like this. So, you know, I guess as these are rolling out, right, we've been seeing inflows basically throughout the entire time of it rolling out, except for maybe this past week where we first saw outflows. So how do you think that traditional finance is, I guess, viewing Bitcoin initially? Because it seemed like initially it was their favorite asset. Do you still think it'll continue that way throughout the rest of the year?
Yeah, in the big picture, it's something has to go wrong or it's unstoppable. I mean, something has to really fail with the technology. Some kind of hack or something that, you know, it's been through those thousand cuts and it survived. Otherwise, I see it as unstoppable. I you know, it's not the classic story is no zealot like a convert. Mm-hmm. Initially, my son first told about me about it when he was undergrad. It was 2012, I think.
Wow.
And silly internet money. And I think we're still good. Yeah, recording. It's silly internet money. But I came over that hump once it went above the price of gold. In terms of Bitcoin versus per ounce price ago, and I believed and still do. But now it's just the macro of what it does is I don't want to get into all that macro. People repeat the same thing every time because we get it. To me, it's more okay, it's known knowns. It's just that common thing. This is a revolutionary technology, trades 24/7, nothing stops it. Everybody in the world can get access to it. It's the only risk asset macro that really trades on weekends, which is good and bad. And you can see that effect sometimes if something happens and geopolitical events and something.
Yeah.
But that to me is an unstoppable force. And it's just there's always going to be that technology. It's new technology, that risk. But otherwise, it's the trend I've enjoyed here at Bloomberg. Here's an example I give you. It's 2017, my team first proposed the Bloomberg Galaxy Crypto Index. The whole idea was I came from an indexing background environment too. I ran the indexing for commodities at S&P. And this space just needs a good broad index. Now it has it already, but eventually be tracked by ETFs. And when we launched that index, I thought, okay, at some point, there's going to be ETFs tracking a broad-based crypto index like the S&P 500, the SPYs. Still not there. Mm-hmm. We got Bitcoin ETFs. But you see the process? It's just happening slowly. It's just a matter of time. What trip set up? I don't know. There's got to be bumps in the road. Like the next one will be Ethereum. It's just a matter of time. And people are going to be complaining about Gary Gensler and stuff like I just like to sit back and let them complain because it's just going to be bumps in the road. It's going to happen. I don't know what stops it. The only thing is, I think, is some kind of glitch in technology, unless you can tell me other risks that I should be worried about. People talking about all these like massive, quant computers or something. Like
yeah. That. I mean, I don't really think that's even possible, right? I mean, the amount of computing power that it takes just to like mine Bitcoin, right? It's my laptop couldn't do it. It would get completely fried. It would probably take like a majority of these computers out here to, you know, continually mine Bitcoin. And it's just, you know, like the ASIC miners, the way that they're set up now, it's like basically their only use is to mine Bitcoin. They're very loud, make a lot of noise, let off a lot of heat. You know, there's a lot of aspects of that. I mean, I think like the current risk right now is the US government's attacking almost the privacy aspect of it.
So let's back up a little bit.
Okay.
Which parts of the US government? So that's why I like to clarify.
Yeah.
There's entities in the US government, oftentimes with political leanings and self-fulfilling reasons to do that. So it's not like China. China's one person.
Yeah.
President Xi. Russia's one person, President Putin. In this country, it's the check and balances. And that's one thing I do love. I stopped you in for a particular reason because crypto people usually look at it as like black and white. Oh, it's the US government. No, there's specific people in that US government and we have checks and balances. Look what happened to Mr. Gensler. He lost in the courts. That's how strong our system is. But is there a better way? Exactly. Yeah. We've got to hash it out, and we need antagonists. So I want you to go back then a little bit. Let's be more specific. Why I just want to clarify with crypto people is the vested interests of virtually everybody in this government is for the betterment of everybody. I mean, that's just the nation. That's the essence of this country. We're all immigrants. Yeah. Lithuanian and European peasants. I mean, especially in Miami, all immigrants, we just want a better life.
No, 100%.
It's just for the masses, obviously. But so that's why I look at it. And also, when you have this competition now with the rest of the world, like with China, I like to say to crypto people when they really get upset about things, okay, we might mess it up in the short term. In the big picture, we never mess anything up.
Yeah.
And that's the history of our country.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree with you 100%. I mean, like there's nobody better place to be an entrepreneur. There's a lot of benefits in being American. Right. But, you know, one thing that's going on right now, and I'm not sure if like traditional finance is really following this. So that's why I kind of want to dive into it. And, but you know, the development of Lightning wallets. Yeah. So like Wallet of Satoshi is one that's very popular in Latin America. It left the US six months ago. Wallet or Phoenix wallet is another one. It's basically like Lightning wallets that do not have KYC. So you're not able to track basically where you're sending payments. You don't have to necessarily enter in your, you know, ID or anything like that. So they're making it very difficult. Founders of Samurai, which also do this thing called Whirlpool, which essentially if you have KYC Bitcoin, you could put it in there theoretically, then it would, you know, it does its thing in the background and then it sends it back to you and it wouldn't be able to be traced. Now, all these things, those founders just got arrested for conspiracy in the US and everything like that. So it seems like the US is kind of attacking that privacy aspect. I think, you know, like you said earlier, that there's too much money to be made. So they'll never try to, you know, ban Bitcoin or anything like that.
Well, if they get votes from constituents.
Yeah, there's no way that they would try to do that. My view personally is that the US government is actually pretty smart the way they're attacking it. Is it would be very difficult for me to send you Bitcoin from me to you right here without, you know, utilizing like something like Cash App or Strike, which is a KYC platform. So they would know that I sent it from me to you. And if I were to send something on chain, those fees are getting a lot higher. So it's very difficult. And like an average person wouldn't really pay for coffee that costs, I don't know, $5. And then there's a dollar fee associated.
Well, that's the question I want to ask you. Why would anybody ever use Bitcoin to buy anything or even gold?
Yeah.
They use dollars are great because they depreciate. You want a little depreciation, but I would think it's silly to use Bitcoin unless you think it's expensive, just sell it and convert to dollars. So I think that's part of the thing. I think I view it as like gold. I'm not gonna use Apple stock to buy anything. I'm not gonna use gold to buy anything, but I'm more traditional. I guess I can invest and get as much exposure I want, but there's no better vehicle on the planet for transacting. It's just, okay, we've had flaws lately, but that part of it is, one thing I think people need to understand is there's original reason for a lot of these laws, and that is because of criminal activity. That are designed to protect all of us. Okay, they're imperfect, but we have to have some of that, or else what do criminals do? They almost always go to the new technology. Bitcoin's been perfect for that, and until the rest of the world catches up.
Gotcha.
But to me, that's the key thing. It's like that's one thing I found very silly right away is some people have to learn the hard way they're young. It's better off not to learn. Pay your taxes. I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
My brother was a broker in a Chicago order trade. He was probably 23 or 4 or so, making a lot of money. The IRS cleared out his bank statement because he wasn't paying his taxes.
Wow.
That was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw this census a lot from crypto people. It's okay. It's wonderful being young. I consider myself young. Hopefully I'll be able to look back from an older person, but you ought to always pay your taxes. The number one rule, I have to look at the camera when I say this, but for crypto people is if there's anything that comes in, if you sell anything, right away, that's a liability for taxes because you have to show a cost basis. Anything. That's the way our system works. It's just the way it is. It's called a capital gain. So if it's done electronically, there's a record.
Yeah.
And that's why a lot of people hold physical gold. And a lot of rich people do. I know some of them.
Yeah.
Because it's harder to track. But cryptos, you can. And it's just the key thing that all crypto people need to understand is once you sell anything, you have to demonstrate a cost basis, but that's a taxable transaction. Always, ever, and anything. Crypto's not exempt.
Yeah, no, I mean, I hear you 100%. And it's like it's a public ledger, right? So, I mean, it makes sense that
It's hard to hide it.
Yeah.
And, well, I guess there's ways to do it. And that's why people have to understand if you're trying to hide it, then why? It's just normal, logical human nature for people to try to regulate and follow the law, I think. But that's what young entrepreneurs and that's new technologies are supposed to bend that a little bit or push the string.
Yeah, push it.
But it's the bottom line is my father's economist is always pay your taxes. It's going to be at the risk.
Yeah.
Just look what happened to Roger Ver.
Yeah.
A lot of us had zero sympathy. Sorry, you made a lot of money. It's wonderful you're American and you're allowed to do that. You're not working in the gulag. Mm-hmm. Just pay your taxes. That's all. Especially if you make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And if it's only a fraction of my father's accountant, he says, well, that's one thing about this country. They can only take a certain portion of your income. And then everything else is what a good accountant does. Mm-hmm. I have a son who's an accountant too.
There we go. Yeah. So, hey, maybe I should hit them up. You should try to help me avoid that. But, you know, you mentioned gold and you view Bitcoin very similar to gold, right? So, I mean, there's been a lot of parallels and comparisons to the gold spot ETF and the Bitcoin spot ETF. Something that I found very interesting is that there's been like net outflows, and I actually heard this from your interview on the Wolf of Wall Street earlier this week, that there's been net outflows in gold ETFs this year. But
for 3 years now, actually starting in 2020.
Okay, and gold's been ripping, right? So there's been net inflows into Bitcoin spot ETFs, but they're only about, if you add up all of the market caps of the 11, it's only about 5% of the overall Bitcoin market cap, last I checked.
But I think, you're talking about ETF market cap?
Yes.
I think the last time I checked, it was around 60 to 70 billion, which is about 30% of total gold ETFs, if you want to apples to apples.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, that's great because I was going to basically ask you then, do you think that it's going to get to a point where the ETFs are taking up that much of the market cap? And, you know, I guess a further question with that is, do you ever think that it would be to a point where, you know, I guess the perception is that traditional finance or like BlackRock or some of these big players could potentially come in and then almost be market makers in Bitcoin where they're able to kind of pull the swings and swing the price a bit?
Let's start there. BlackRock does not hold Bitcoin. They have products for people buy to buy Bitcoin. And it's one of the things I've really enjoyed. Maybe they did something to help manage the products, but it's something that's very similar to, I worked at an ETF firm. I was the head of research at ETF Securities, which is now part of Aberdeen. And you put out a product, clients buy the product, let's say gold, and you have to physically get that gold and put it in a vault. Bitcoin's the same way. They don't really do it, but they have a product that tracks it. So it's just one of those things that it's good to explain how that works. I'll back up with gold a little bit. And here's the facts of gold. Gold is becoming the backup currency to US dollar right now in the big picture. The unlimited friendship between President Xi and President Putin shifted the world order. And the way I look at it, now the biggest buyers in gold on the planet are central banks. The numbers I've checked recently, since 2020, that's when gold ETFs peaked, there's been a total selling of about 30 million ounces of gold ETFs. It's gone from about 110 million to about 81 million. That's unprecedented with the price of going up about 30% over the same time. So 30 million ounces of gold ETFs outflows. At the same time, there's been about 100 million ounces of central bank buying of gold. Unprecedented amount, according to the World Gold Council. Mm-hmm. And part of that is the world's shifted. Who's the biggest buyer of gold? It's China. Latest, Turkey. The latest data from Q1 from the World Gold Council was 290 metric tons. That's the most Q1 ever net buying of gold from central banks. Why? And who's buying them? Well, China's number one. Turkey's up there. Singapore Monetary Exchange is one of those. People are looking at gold. Okay, now we have this little issue with the dollar. It can be weaponized. I get it. They want this. What other currencies even close? Nothing. Dollar's a 10. Yeah. And it's on fiat currencies. Everything else, maybe the closest one is a 5, and that's a euro. And they don't even have a military, and they don't have a bond market. Not even close. So for transactions, the dollar's the best. Gold's a backup. People actually, central banks are actually increasing their reserves of gold. Mm-hmm. And the way I say it, I do agree with Saifedean Ammous's book, The Bitcoin Standard. I remember reading in 2018 when he predicted that central banks would eventually buy gold. And I thought, oh, that's silly. He's been right. I mean, I'm sure he's been right. The trend is that way. I mean, it just, what stops that? So the way I look at it is at some point, if they're going to hold gold, you probably have to have a percentage of Bitcoin in a space unless you're going to take that risk. But to me, that's where it ropes down to. Let's look at existing trends. And then that's what I do always as strategists. What's the pre-existing trend? Is it predominant and will it end? There's a pre-existing trend. And like I ask my kids, their average age is 28. Like I ask you, does any 30-something or less give a damn care about gold? No, they're on cryptos. I get it. The world's going that way. So they're buying gold. I'm sorry, buying Bitcoin or cryptos. It's boomerangs. I love another term I love from crypto people, boomerangs. I published that one in the terminal. And my editor goes, what's this? And finally, he let me get it through and people enjoyed it. But it's that transition. But the existing trend is there's increasing demand adoption for Bitcoin. ETFs are a good example of that. And there's significant outflows in gold ETFs, but yet the price is going up. That's sufficient, significant divergent strength. I'm still bullish gold, long-term, very bullish Bitcoin, but I'm expecting a bit of a global recession to kick in. And I think gold's sniffing that out. So what's going to happen, and here's a quote I'll end with gold, is I've been using is for most ETF investors, who are kind of more westernized, the Western elite, the 1 billion of the, 8 billion total of the world. Why buy gold if the S&P 500 is on a tear and you can get 5% in T-bills? And that's been happening. That's going to change. There'll be some reversion. At some point, we'll have a bear market in the stock market. At some point, interest rates will go down. I think it might be starting this year. And those gold ETFs will start to switch into inflows, which will add to the central bank buying, which will probably give up a little bit. And that's part of the gold bull market. I think it's a matter of time the gold gets to $3,000 an ounce. It's built a good floor around $2,000. I think it's a matter of time Bitcoin gets to 100,000. But if I'm right about a normal recession, a little bit of beta backup, meaning the S&P 500, Bitcoin's going to suffer and gold will do well. That's, it depends how the rest of this work year works out. But it's that big picture macro that you can't really talk about gold anymore without saying Bitcoin. And that is something I've been saying for 5 years. And I was considered an idiot by some tradfi, and now it's just that majority is becoming more and more of a minority every day that don't believe in Bitcoin. And what stops that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think at this point anything can really stop it, right? I mean, the fact that these traditional finance products, the spot ETFs are out there, it's like, all right, there's no real escaping Bitcoin at this point. So I think people are starting to slowly come around. I mean, it was a lot more resistance, I feel like, last bull run, especially in 2020 when we saw that going up. I mean, I know traditional finance was all over it on Twitter, dunking on it when it dropped from like, I don't know, 8 to 10,000 to 4, which I'm sure you remember those times too. When everything was crashing. But, you know, you talked about the way that gold and Bitcoin will react during a potential recession. You said that they react kind of differently to that. Why do you view it that way if you view Bitcoin as more of like, I guess, like digital gold?
It's number one thing is, let's start with a simple fact, is we have not had a bear market in the U.S. stock market other than these 20% or so corrections since the bottom in 2009. Mm-hmm. We're overdue. I've been early. I've been wrong. I think now that everybody said it's not going to happen, it will. But the bottom line is when beta falls, virtually everything falls initially. And that's what, even gold, it's just gold will come back. But the fact is, Bitcoin typically trades at 3 times the volatility of beta, and it's just almost inconceivable. Here's a term that I need people to understand in this space. It's called the value at risk model. When you're, the whole world is like basically for money managers, a value at risk model. Hedge funds have value at risk models. They manage all their positions and they try to determine what's the value I have at risk. And if you put in any model, the S&P 500 dropping 10%, virtually every model will spit out over time. Most risk assets with a higher volatility will drop more, unless it has a designated negative delta, meaning it's designed to go up if the stock market goes down. That's the way life is. So that's what I'm anticipating at some point. Did we start that correction? Maybe. And then, I mean, in beta, and then it comes back like, oh, at some point, we got to get over that test. So that to me is the key thing to remember. It's the value at risk model. A risk asset, one of the riskiest on the planet, that has a much higher volatility than beta will almost always go down when beta goes down. That's just a fact. It would be delightful if it doesn't. And then I can have so many cool things to write about, but I got to see the test first. I got to see proof of that. But what's happening, as I pointed out, is so far this year, at the end of April, gold closed at its highest price ever on an end of month basis, and both Bitcoin and S&P 500 closed below their all-time month-end highs. Maybe it's just a little tweak, but at some point, what I try to do is try to pick up the little inflection points.
Gotcha. Understood. And then, you know, I mean, you mentioned it a little bit earlier about a potential inflection point with a recession and, you know, whether what Jerome Powell does with interest rates this year is going to be pretty interesting, right? I mean, everybody's been trying to, it seems like the market's been calling for an interest rate cut since last year. But I mean, I'm under the camp that I think earliest at this point is going to be Q4, maybe not even seeing it this year just because of the way inflation's going and everything like that. But traditionally, when we see an interest rate cut, that usually leads to a recession. Now,
it's when the recession's getting started. That really leads to it. They're responding to this, that is coming.
Okay. Yeah. That's thank you for the clarification. Yeah. I appreciate that because I mean,
I'll give you the examples if you want.
Yeah. Yeah. Go into it, please.
Well, 2007 was the first rate cut, September.
Okay.
And the recession didn't really kick in until Lehman collapsed in September of 2008, September 15th, I think it was.
Okay.
I worked there for a little while on the receivership. But why did the Fed start cutting rates? Because inflation was actually high because the housing market started collapsing and all the CES was locking up. So they started cutting in 2007. So that's what started that. And then, of course, the market didn't bottom until March 2009. Let's go back to 2000. That's when the stock market was the most expensive ever, except maybe compared to 1929, if you compare it versus GDP, the internet bubble. Market already was down in 2000. They started cutting rates in January 2001. So it was on the way down, and the bottom didn't come until March or so 2002. So they started cutting on the way down because everything started imploding. This time, it's different. Greatest thing to say. I thought I'd get a smile on you. Yeah. What I think is going to happen, my view, is the Fed will not cut rates until the stock market goes down and tells them to. Here's why. Because it's the most expensive ever in the history of mankind in terms of most, well, GDP, in terms of the rest of the world. Highest stock S&P 500 has been versus commodities in 25 years versus sales and versus most of the rest of the world stock markets. So it's creating inflation. It's part of the wealth effect, property values. And when Powell pivoted early last year, he helped keep inflation sticky. Someone admitted, but it was my call. And now that's the problem. The high price cure that's affected commodities, you know, when commodities go down because they go up, that's just the way commodities work. Is trickling over to the stock market. To me, the Fed's not going to ease until stock market goes down and tells them to. If that doesn't happen, everybody can blame me because I think that's the way it's going to happen. I look at Chairman Powell. So what happened today? The number came out a little bit weaker than expected. It was one of the things I got right because I heard his testimony. It sounded to me like he got the numbers that you should get it before.
Yeah.
And showing signs of this long-awaited, this pendulum that swung towards severe recession last year that didn't happen, now swung completely towards no recession. It's just going to swing back a little bit. But that's what's happening. The high price cure is affecting the stock market. Bitcoin's a good leading indicator. Cryptos, all the altcoins having those big pumps was like, you don't ease in that environment. The Fed never eases in speculative frenzies. S&P 500 making all-time highs. Bitcoin making all-time highs. That's when you take away the punch bowl.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we're in the hangover of that right now. And I think we're bouncing. But that's the problem, I think, with Bitcoin. So I'll give you my outlook for this year's stock market will not ease. We will not ease this year until the stock market goes down, at least has a 10% correction, S&P 500. We always do that in bull markets. 20% is considered bear markets.
Yeah,
we'll get there. And that's what's going to drag down, I think, part of the riskiest ask of Bitcoin. That's why I'm still very bullish gold. I still think Bitcoin or long bonds are going to be some of the best performers. I've been wrong. But still bullish gold, and I still very bearish things like copper and crude oil. But Bitcoin is a good leading indicator, and that's what I'm afraid of. It might, at some point, you know, it's just the first thing in a weekend. It's the first thing you can get liquidity, buy or sell, instant settlement. It's just when you can't in futures, you can trade, you know, S&P in liquid futures for the broad commodities on end of Friday and Sunday night and then in the evening, but it's just not as liquid as Bitcoin.
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely. And you know, it seems like there's a lot of, you know, crazy psychopaths that are like holding Bitcoin and will never sell it, right? But there's a lot of new money that's coming in here, right? Yeah. So, I mean, obviously any sign of, you know, potential dip, we're seeing now outflows after we saw, you know, the initial run up with the ETF launch. We're seeing outflows now for the first time. So I wouldn't be surprised either if we see like kind of a dip and then, you know.
That's hot money.
Yeah.
That's hot money. It's the buy and hold that really is going to help. But Bitcoin's great for trading.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you brought up the halving earlier. And, you know, if you look at the wallets with over one Bitcoin, I think it's like 60% or maybe even more haven't moved that coin in over a year. So I think, you know, I guess you brought up the simple supply and demand. Do you view that as like that big of a driver as price, like going forward?
Oh, we can't ignore the fact that you have that. It was just brilliant NGU technology, number yeah. go up technology. I used that in a Bloomberg headline. They wouldn't let me do it. I'd say, as you can see by the time this interview, I'm not the best English speaker, but
no, that's fine.
I'm from Southside Chicago. We don't say the Bears, we say da Bears. But I just love that. It's classic number go up technology. I mean, it just, when I remember really digging into it and explaining to my cousin who was a hedge fund guy, and so they can just create more supply. I'm like, they can't.
Yeah.
At that time, it was 1,800 a day. Now it then went to 900, now 450 a day. That's yeah. just from a commodity guy. We don't have that high price cure. So why is crude oil right now, the price that we're speaking is $79 a barrel. It was first traded in 2006. Why? Because every time it goes up, we create more supply and we reduce demand. It's the opposite when it goes down.
Yeah.
Bitcoin's not that way. And gold is the only commodity that's similar. You just can't create more of it. 2% a year on average for over history has been an increase in gold supply. That's why people use kind of 2% for CPI and everything, or for targets. But that's for me, if a commodity guy, it's that definitive. Don't mess with it. Don't mess with supply. It's just going down. I did a chart in this like 4 or 5 years ago. I set it up in the terminal. I said, this is where it's going to be 5 years from now. I'm like, I've never saw that anything, any place ever. So all that matters is demand and adoption. And we just got through one of the biggest things we've been waiting for literally 4 or 5 years. I mean, yeah. when did the Winklevoss twins first,
yeah.
was it like 10 years ago?
I think so. So
we got over that hump. We made a new high. Now it's a hangover. And that's, to me, is a problem short term. But big picture, it's one thing I love about it is trading is so important in markets. You got to have traders to create liquidity. It's the first thing I learned in trading business. One bit of two, two bit of three. You just they're making markets all the time. They get in and out. They play the flip. In Bitcoin, it's all bots and algorithms out, but it's that liquidity that matters. So when the institutions want to play, they get the liquidity. But to me, for people like me, is just supposed to longer term investors are supposed to. I think what's happening is everybody's starting to get the fact that I probably should have some of this in my portfolio.
Yeah,
get off zero. You've heard people say that. I've agreed that with them forever. Got to get off zero. And to me, that's the mentality kicking in. And I have to say, well, it's just, you have to have something break. Otherwise, why should the demand and adoption stop? It's going to have blips. But in the big picture, look at 5, 10 years from now. What stops this? Big picture, I don't see what stops it.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, I might play devil's advocate with you a little bit here.
We got to disagree.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, you know, with the halving, obviously, you know, it's a big event, right? I mean, it's built into the code. I think the decentralization aspect and the halving are two of the, you know, most incredible phenomena that's ever been created. But my thought is, with the halving, there's less than 10% of the overall coins left to be mined. So 90% of the coins are out there. So I'm of the opinion that the human behavior, the hodlers, the people that are like refusing to sell, those are the people that are more so driving the markets, less than the miners necessarily. Because, I mean, obviously energy costs are going up around the world, right? The miners, the way that thing is going, they're going to have to get, you know, mitigate those costs. So, you know, in a sense, they'll be driving the market somewhat. But I don't think it's as big of a driver of price as the overall human behavior.
But the fact that there is absolutely zero response to price in supply is shocking to me. You can't change it.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it could drop less than 450 coins a day.
Yeah.
Could that happen? Is that?
I mean, it'll happen in the, well, I mean, it's 450 about, right? So it really just depends on like the block cycle and everything like that. So some days it can be more, some days
but overall it's 450.
Yeah, about the average for this halving. Yeah.
That to me is all that matters. And that's why I'll let you dig into the details. I just put that in like, okay, I get it. That's all I need to know.
Yeah.
And everything else will just kind of make me lose my hair. And as long as you can't, I mean, even if you can cut supply, that's still a bullish factor. It's just the fact that you can't have more than 450 in no way, shape or form through code is, that's all you need to know on the supply side. Next subject, I always slip to tilt, and that's all that matters to demand.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, that's the beauty of Bitcoin, right? I mean, it's just the simplicity of it, the supply and demand. Like, it's just so easy to grasp for the average person. So I think that's why a lot of people are, you know, I guess gravitating towards that. But, you know, I want to take it a step back, right? Because you've been in the traditional finance space for a while. You've been in the Bitcoin space, you know, following it since 2017 about, right?
Well, I started writing about it at Bloomberg 2017.
Okay.
Started really watching it 2011, 2012. I can't remember exactly when I was at S&P. And my first thought is, oh, this is compared to gold.
Yeah.
And like I heard it from my fund some first.
Yeah.
He mined a little and lost the laptop.
There, I mean, that's a classic story there. Yeah. But, you know, how has the change of the narrative around Bitcoin changed in the traditional finance space throughout your time of starting to write about it?
Oh, I so enjoyed writing about it. Because initially, it's something that hasn't changed in since I first started writing about it. It's silly internet money. So I remember some people in my office were involved with GBTC, and I wasn't. And they would ask me about it, and I'm like, well, I just think the price is going up. I'm not allowed to give investment advice. This is where I think the price is going. You make your decision. Over what time? Well, sometimes it's short term, sometimes long term. But it's enjoyable seeing the classic human nature of rapidly advancing technology and people adopting it slowly. Like the example they always use of, well, one thing that technology has it going for is people die. The old people die off. I mean, I will too. And then just the young people move in. And that's just the way it is. But like Bloomberg is, I think, taking a little step back with me. But I work with that. You know, I work with the team. I love Bloomberg. They asked me to curtail coverage. But the rest of the firm, we've done so much to really I remember having meetings with senior management. And this is before we started our coverage in. We've really picked up coverage in media before we started a Bloomberg TV show. I was an advisor to that. Just one of the many people. It's nothing but what you'd say. I'd say watch the big trends. It's nothing but increasing demand and adoption, but there's always got to be bumps in the road. There's got to be the Peter Schiffs. We need antagonists. Mm-hmm. That's so important in our society. Because if you don't have antagonists, then if you all agree, that's not worth it. And you're just Z. And that's, but so I see nothing but that continuing process. And right now, I think we're in a bit of a blip with me and with Bloomberg Intelligence, but the rest of Bloomberg is still covering it completely. And one thing that we noticed right away that I talked to the, pointed out to the media people, you get a lot of readers.
Yeah.
And that's the bottom line when you're in the media side, you need clicks.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's true.
You got to have clicks. And I like to say, I can write the best readership, best research in the world. But if I don't have a good headline and I don't get clicks, I'm worthless.
Yeah.
People have to click on it.
100%. And you know, you brought up Peter Schiff, right? I mean, he's the great antagonist.
But I have to bring him up because I know him personally.
Well, and I think like he knows what he's doing at this.
In Weston.
Yeah, really? Okay.
Weston, Connecticut. We both moved.
Okay. Yeah, because I think like he's understood that, right? I mean, like, I think, you know, he goes on all these Bitcoin shows. When he gets onto TV, he talks about Bitcoin all the time. I think he understands that, you know, he's going to get a rise out of people. But what the interesting thing about him is, you know, I think he's obviously a gold bug, right? So he sees the market very similar to how a lot of Bitcoiners see it. What do you think is that disconnect? I mean, not just with him, but with maybe some of the other gold bugs who haven't come around to Bitcoin. Is it maybe the physical aspect of it? Like, what's the like one driver that doesn't, like, I guess the traditional gold bug might not click with Bitcoin?
It's one of those fascinating things I've always loved about human nature, how my wife can love owls and I hate owls.
Yeah.
We're all, it's food. I mean, I just... and I hate spinach. She loves spinach. And
yeah.
I love broccoli. She's like, you know, it's just, it's the same way. And some people just don't change. But what I think is I really enjoy bringing, I brought up his name because I thought it would, partly because he's what's so important in these kind of things. You need a classic antagonist. And I've been using the example when people talk about Elizabeth Warren, when people raise their hand in life to be basically the Aaron Burr of society versus Alexander Hamilton, I'm like, let them do it. And just move ahead. But Peter Schiff's laughing all the way to the bank.
Yeah.
He's very wealthy and he's done very well for himself. And I remember making fun of Liberace. You ever hear about Liberace?
No.
He was an entertainer, singer, and everything. Okay. People like made fun, but he laughed all the way to the bank. He just had his shtick and it worked for him. But in this case, I just look at it as if he's willing to take that risk, he has, of having all gold and no Bitcoin, he's missed out on a lot of appreciation. That's a known. Now what's going forward is I think it'll still happen. He'll miss out on that better performance. And he's taken an inordinate risk. Anybody has just gold and pushes back on Bitcoin, take an inordinate risk of the digital version of gold not competing with the regular version of gold in the world going digital. I mean, we all have these things.
Yeah,
now. I mean,
exactly.
Just I looked at it very simple. That's one thing I've always, I love technology as long as it's cost effective and productive. And it's just the things that I think, oh, he's classic Western elite too.
Yeah. You
gotta go live overseas, go live in a bad country. I mean, it's kind of ingrained in me being from my Lithuanian side of family, kind of left, you know, fled the Bolsheviks. And we kind of ingrained that. Living in Europe, I lived in Europe. I learned about the old Franks and the new Franks. I remember traveling in Greece. I learned my lesson about Greece. You got to eat your way out of the country with drachmas because the drachmas were worthless outside of Greece. So I go, okay, I'll eat a lot of euros. So I just ate my way. I remember things like that. Understanding different currencies, fiat currencies. And by the way, there's only one universal electronic thing. Is a currency? Is it, I look at more as gold.
Okay.
And then, but the fact that you can get access to the dollar on this thing to me is just as profound, actually more profound for transactions.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you 100%, but you've been very generous with your time and allowing me to come in here. But before I let you go, I want to give one last question. What do you see as a big turning point or maybe something of note that you're keeping your eye on for the rest of 2024 as we're recording this, what, May 3rd?
To me, it's all about the macro now. Beta is everything. And I look at the U.S. stock market, beta meaning the S&P 500 is the most expensive in my lifetime. And it's way overdue for a normal bear market correction. And I think the setup is classic. People have heard this before me. So, oh, I'm a glum saying that again. I'm like, I've been wrong. But I found other places outperform. Gold is outperforming beta this year since 2021, since 2017. Gold's outperforming the AI-driven S&P 500. I'm like, that's not good. If this stupid rock, which it is beating stocks, which stocks should outperform rock over history because of human ingenuity and they're designed to go higher. But to me, that's the macro. We're overdue for a normal recessionary bear market. The stock market is so expensive. People just look at my Twitter and LinkedIn can see how I point that out. And it's just no. So the key thing is reversion. Mean reversion is the most powerful force in markets. So right now, stock market's very expensive. Bonds in the U.S. are extraordinarily cheap on a global basis. You know, the 10-year yield in this country is like 260. It's dropped a little bit. In China, I'm sorry, it's 460. In China, it's 230. New all-time lows. So that's the second largest country in the world. That's the one that's, so to me, that's part of the problem. We're having a classic mean reversion process that's happening in the rapidly emerging, it happens most rapidly expanding emerging markets, China. It's doing what China and Soviet Union did about 30 years ago. So that to me is the key leading. The U.S. is probably going to have that recession that most people have forgotten about. Unemployment starting to bottom and go higher. And to me, in that environment, when risk assets go down, Bitcoin's going to probably go down with risk assets. And gold will probably outperform. And U.S. Treasury long bonds will probably outperform. So by the end of this year, if this is not happening, I probably put kill on it and eat it and say, yeah, I was wrong. But I was early, and now it's starting happening. Like, I started looking for crude oil to go to $50 on its way up above 100. I was wrong on the way up, and it's heading that way now. I've been looking for gold to break above $2,000 an ounce for about 3 years. Finally doing it. But that's how markets are. They have to make it difficult. And that's one key thing, Brandon, I'm really worried about Bitcoin. When I get it, I don't track as much anymore, but I listen to and I watch this, the excessive bullishness. And when people say when, rather than if, about going to 100,000, that's when you know you kind of have to have a bit of a correction. People have to learn the hard way. Markets always do that. And then when they start saying if, then they'll probably be more likely to go higher.
Yeah, I mean, you predicted 100K by 25. I made a bet earlier this year that I think it's going to be 100K by the end of the year. So, I mean, I don't know, maybe. And if I lose, I have to eat like a couple red hot chili peppers or something.
Likely to happen if I'm wrong about beta and stock market keeps marching higher. To me, it's this big disconnect. We're way overdue for the big test. All-time record highs in U.S. stock market. If that keeps going up, Bitcoin should outperform. The thing is, I love to overplay with gold. It's gold that Bitcoin gold ratio has been actually showing pretty divergent weakness since versus the stock market, which keeps me bullish gold.
Yeah.
And it kind of tilts towards what I'm thinking is the macro. So if beta goes up, you're right. But now if beta goes down and Bitcoin takes off, now that's very profound.
Yeah.
Which to me is a very unlikely event. And now that's the thing that's happening now is more and more hedge funds are getting involved in this. And that's smart money. They have this smart, I mean, that's, I just try to assume the stuff I don't know. I was at a hedge fund. Yeah. The stuff they do now is all algorithms, all AI, a bunch of PhD quants.
Yeah.
That'll be a key thing if it happens. So it's a key thing. I made a bet with Dave Weisberg early in this year. I hope I lose. I really hope I lose that gold would outperform Bitcoin this year. Now it's way switched the other way. Gold's still going. Gold's like the turtle and Bitcoin's like the rabbit. Just kind of, but I want to lose that bet. I mean, it's a dinner.
Yeah.
Because if I'm right, it's that scenario. I'm worried about that. It's a great trading environment, but it's bad for most of society. We're just way overdue for a wealth creation correction.
Yeah, and I think it's coming as well. So, Mike, thanks so much, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure meeting you. And
yeah,
we'll enjoy sitting down. Let's do it again.
Yeah, for sure.
Especially when you drive all the way from Tampa.
Yeah, I know.